Welcome to Hit Continue Metagame.
Episode 105. I'm your host, Scott Watmo.
That's not even right. Nope. There's no rightness on that, on any level.
I said that I would try to screw you up the moment that we started.
That's fair. The show where we go beyond the games and talk about the history of game companies and game creators.
Yeah.
I am Greg Pilkington. Joining me, as always, is Scott the Rot Watmo.
The Rot.
Yeah. And... Oh. James Baby Shorts Fantuso.
With two T's like a dog.
Oh, see, I was just thinking
the
like
Rottweiler.
More zombie-like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Like you've emerged from the sewer and there's skin drooping from you as you shamble ever closer to your consumer destiny.
I could be a zombie dog. Okay. Hey, speaking of destiny.
Speaking of destiny, we're not quite there yet, though.
Ah.
Because where we left off in... Last episode, we just finished up the Halo trilogy.
Ah.
The problem with that is there was two more Halos.
Yeah.
What we just ended on was that Bungie had just won? Yeah, I'm going to say won its independence from Microsoft, signing a Declaration of Independence, to which they celebrated quite uproariously, and we got a quote from Harold Ryan and all that fun stuff. But now we are on to... Halo ODST. So, from 2007 to 2010, Bungie would release its last two games in the Halo franchise before leaving the entirety of the world-changing, record-breaking IP in the hands of Microsoft.
Woo! Yeah.
These two games were Halo 3 ODST.
Halo Firefly.
Yep.
And for those of you who don't know, Orbital Drop Shock Trooper.
Exactly. And Halo Reach. Both games were effectively prequels to what Bungie had already established through the games and supplementary content.
Was Odds a prequel?
No.
It was a midquel.
Okay.
It was happening, if I recall correctly, happening around the same time as Halo 3.
Yeah, it was like a side story, wasn't it?
We'll get into it. We'll get into it. Sure. You're close. You're close. You're a little wrong, but you're close. ODST would bridge a lower key perspective of the events between Halo 2 and Halo 3,
oh.
While Reach would predate Combat Evolved by telling the story of the human settlement that the ship, the Pillar of Autumn, escaped from to eventually stumble upon the first Halo ring.
Rip Noble 6.
Exactly. ODST was the biggest removal from what Bungie originally had done to date in the Halo franchise. It released in September of 2009 and was met with pretty positive critic reviews and somewhat mixed reviews from fans.
There was some weird, like, the sort of, like, mid-between mission components were, like, a little... Like, it was like solve a mystery, kind of.
Yeah, exactly.
It was
so
weird.
Although it didn't receive nearly as much praise as its predecessor, it still sold 3 million units worldwide by the end of the year, and more so afterwards, as it was also going to be the platform players could use when Reach's multiplayer beta went live. The story revolves around Rookie and his new squad of Orbital Dropshot Troopers, or ODST, after the initial attack on New Mombasa in Halo 2. The ODST are a group of elite-trained soldiers that, before the Spartan program that made the Master Chief, were considered the top echelon of soldiers for the UNSC.
And now, Deite.
Deite. They're top, but, you know.
I mean, listen. Let's face it. They're still there. I mean, the Spartan program has, what, 4 units left?
Actually, so much more now, as we'll get into.
Yeah, Deite.
Sort of. As the name suggests, they are deployed...
Sergeant Nathan Fillion.
Yeah, that's ODST, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. As the name suggests, they are deployed from orbit and drop into designated war zones. In this case, they were dropped into New Mombasa just as the last major Covenant warship was retreating from Earth. Despite the retreat, there were still Covenant forces in the air, and the city had been completely overrun. During the drop, Rookie and his team are separated due to the shockwave generated from the Covenant warship making its retreat through slip space.
I thought that's what the S was for, though. Aren't they usually pretty good at dealing with shockwaves?
They are...
They're not orbital drop everything is fine troopers.
No, but the shock is not pertaining to the waves of space.
Right.
And, you know, slipstreams.
The shock is like them surprising
arriving.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like...
Oh, they're shocking?
Yeah, you're walking down a hallway and they're like, huh! And then you're like, whoa, that's surprising.
Exactly. Shock can mean more than one thing, Scott. Clearly.
It's like when you're walking around your house in the dark and then your roommate's also awake, but you don't know, and he taps you on the shoulder and you're like, huh!
Yeah.
Where are you?
Orbital Drop surprising trooper. Ah.
Exactly. It could have been that, but it doesn't roll off the tongue as well.
No.
The gameplay then centers around Rookie as he tries to discover where his squad is and what happened to him. This is done by finding evidence and clues of what happened to each member. After watching a brief cinematic, the game then gives you control over that particular squad mate for the mission. Once it's over, the player then controls Rookie again, so the player can find the next clue. So after the Peter Jackson movie project had fallen through, which we talked about last episode, Bungie had developers with an abundance of time who needed a project. Originally pitched as a 2 to 3 hour campaign, Harold Ryan, the president of Bungie at the time, gave ODST just over a year to be developed, which is crazy. Bungie originally thought the game might focus on a group of Special Force elites, but eventually settled on telling the story of the ODST during a point in the Halo trilogy that fans felt they had missed out on, which of course was the Battle of Earth in Halo 2. Which, if you guys remember, Halo 2 was the most divisive of the trilogy because of its third of game cut off in the back end.
There was an ending to Halo 2 in a
minute. A little bit of a combat blue balls.
Well, yeah. I think it was, as far as
the sequel.
The sorted...
Combat blue balls.
As far as the sorted history of Halo goes, I think Halo 2 was the beginning of...
the end.
Well, no, what would Ethan call it? Liegate or whatever for Halo 5?
Oh, it was...
Hunt the Truth?
Hunt the Truth, Hunt the Lie.
Hunt the Lie, yeah, that's exactly. It. I think Halo 2 was the Hunt the Lie because all the promotional material for Halo 2 was, you know, they're coming to Earth.
Go to Earth, fight the thing.
Fight the thing. And we got 1.5 missions on Earth, I think, in Halo 2.
They sold us Go to Earth, Fight the Thing. We got Go to Earth.
We left Earth, and then we were like, oh no, another Halo.
Yeah. Yeah. Wake me up when you need me.
Yeah. Before you go.
We need you now.
Chief, Earth needs you. Yeah, I guess.
Always. Yeah. The game used a more film noir ambiance to tell a hard-boiled story rather than the action-adventure approach they had taken for Master Chief's story. This meant a jazzier soundtrack, simulated rain, a sprawling hub city, nighttime settings, and an overall grittier mood. This required Bungie to redesign a lot of small aspects of what players knew to be Halo, yet still stay true to a lot of the mechanics and design elements that made Halo so great. For example, they added silencers on guns. They figured Chief had never been in a situation where he needed a silencer.
Really? The 7'5", 800-pound killing machine didn't need a silencer?
But for the much more squishy ODST...
Oh, Scott. He is the silencer.
So sneak up on a grunt. You think that would wake up other grunts, just bashing someone's skull in to their... torso cavity.
The guy who can one-armed flip an entire Jeep doesn't need a silencer, guys.
Scott, he can one-armed flip a tank.
He can one-armed flip the Scorpion.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember that. Hold X to wait. How did you do that?
So they also, for the first time, gave players a map orientating themselves in the big city. They redesigned AI to move independently to the player's actions and made them all proportionately bigger due to the ODST not being as... tall, massive as the Chief.
Well, you know, Dai.
Dai. On top of all that, Bungie also pulled larger known sci-fi action actors to play the team, such as Nathan Fillion, Trisha Helfer, Alan Tudyk, Alec Baldwin.
I think they got the gaming industry cast of Firefly.
No, they did not. They did not do Gina Torres, and they did not do. They didn't do the mechanic.
Jewel State.
They didn't do the Doctor.
Whose name I can't remember right now. It's Simon Tam.
They didn't do Summer Glau.
Yeah.
They didn't do Gina Torres. Is
Marina Baccarin in it?
No.
Okay.
So they got
some
three.
Some of Firefly.
Yeah, they got three.
Right.
And gaming industry legend Nolan North.
Sure.
The multiplayer of the game was also atypical. Instead of using a PvP, ODST offered a new PvE game mode called Firefight, which centered around players coming together to defend off hordes of enemies.
One of my favorites.
Yep. Reaching
Objective
for the stars.
Survive.
Yeah. Next, Halo Reach, released September of 2010. It would be the final Halo game directly published by Bungie. The game was met to critical and fan acclaim, reaching 200 million in the first day of sales. Within a month, the game sold over 3.3 million units worldwide. Once again, Bungie had cracked records and showed off their absolutely dedicated fan base.
Man, I loved just like making your own Spartan.
Yep.
That was nice.
Yeah, it was definitely one of the best customizations that they had done to date.
Pretty much only because it wasn't vast by any means, but it was just like, here, you got three color options and you can initially work through like four helmets and some shoulder pads.
Yeah.
That's fine.
In Combat Evolved, I think there was like 18 colors, I think.
Or something like that.
But it didn't.
Combat Evolved?
Yeah. Really? But it didn't really matter because if you did Team Deathmatch, you were either red versus blue.
Yeah.
Or you were doing campaign and you were green.
Yeah, you were both Chief.
But we'll get into that. Although ODST was the first time the franchise had stepped away from players following Master Chief, Reach was the first time players got to control another Spartan other than Master Chief. In this game, players played as Noble 6, a Spartan 3, and the newest addition to the Spartan Noble team. Now, if you recall way back when we were talking about Combat Evolved and the book The Fall of Reach, the book that released prior to the first game that only barely existed by forcing Bungie's hand, well, that's what this game is all about.
RIP Nobles 1 through 5.
Nope. Not true, actually. There was a Noble that survived.
Was there?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into it because I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Noble 3.
Okay. Sniper.
I think so, yeah.
Jin.
Jin, yeah. I think it was Noble 3. Maybe it was Noble 4.
Something like that.
Reach was one of the last interstellar human colonies during the Human Covenant War. With it being nearly identical to Earth, it was the UNSC's main military hub. After being assigned to Noble Team, Noble 6 and Squad defended Dr. Catherine Halsey, the mastermind of the Spartan program, from Covenant invaders. She informs the team that the Covenant were looking for important information that humans had in their possession. Noble Team discovers that the initial Covenant were merely the beginning of a full-scale invasion, so they must attempt to break the invasion before it begins. Although they are successful in stopping the initial forces, the Covenant send an even larger force to ensure victory. Noble Team is then assigned to transport the AI Cortana and the vital information she possesses to the UNS ship, UNSC ship, the Pillar of Autumn.
UNS ship.
There's a lot of...
the Pillar of Autumn. For ship. UN ship, sea ship.
What does this mean on your planet? Gratitude. By doing so, they allow the Autumn, Master Chief, and Cortana to escape so they may discover the first Halo ring, setting up Halo Combat Evolved. The game is beautiful. Not only did it push the graphical boundaries of the 360 and the understanding of graphics at Bungie, it was also this super tragic story of unsung heroes whose actions led to the ending of the war. Marcus Leto, the longtime art director at Bungie, helmed the project. Originally, the intention for Reach was to port assets from Halo 3, but after looking at what the team could do, they decided that they owed it to themselves and fans to update their work. By using Halo 3 assets as a base, the team realized they could feasibly rebuild most aspects of the game without investing too much time. A new engine was built from the old, and nearly every single element of Halo was revisited. As a result, a Reach assault rifle had a higher polygon count than an entire Marine in Halo 3.
Oh my god.
That's a lot of polygons for one gun. But because this game was a prequel, several considerations and changes were made to accommodate the story into the gameplay. In Halo 2, Bungie had rid itself of health packs and instead stuck to an ever-regenerating shield and health system, but Combat Evolved had a separated UI for health and shields. In order to stay consistent, Reach used CE's system instead of the updated one. However, since fighting on a military human settlement, Reach also featured a support feature players could find and swap during the game. Though it was similar to the equipment items in Halo 3, these items were reusable and on a timer, while their previous iteration were single-use. This included a jetpack, bubble shield, active camouflage, armor lock, and for the first time, sprint. Yes, that's right. Game-changing FPS franchise took 9 years to implement a sprint function, and it is still hotly debated as to whether that was a good choice or not, because people felt that Halo wasn't about the sprint. It wasn't about the speed of gameplay.
Yeah.
Right? They wanted that plotting, methodical pace that Chief had.
It was a little tankier. If you think about something like Call of Duty, which kind of had, or at least from the Modern Warfare franchise, had sprint from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, it was really designed around those, like, really, really three-second bursts of speed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Halo's a little tankier. It's got a little bit more in terms of, like, cover that you can run from space to space so you can sustain a little bit, get your health back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, melee is really, really satisfying and rewarding because when you get to that point, it's because you earned it.
Yeah, and in Halo Reach, we got assassinations for the first time, that was pretty sweet.
Those are great.
Internally, Bungie was concerned at the lack of a cinematic explosive ending, but eventually a, quote, more significant and emotionally impactful ending won out. They believed that giving the players control of Noble Six's and Reach's final moments would give players a more lasting impression to the game. I think it totally achieved that
objective. Survive.
Yeah. Yes. To further this intensity, they used a closer, more involved camera lens for cinematics rather than the sweeping dynamic shots they had used for Master Chief's story. This was a removal from what Bungie had set as a precedent for the Halo franchise, but it wasn't the only removal. Players could also choose Noble Six to be either female or male. In order to make either choice immersive, dialogue was recorded for either pronoun, and in promotional material and even on the game's box art, Noble Six was left out so that players could build their own narrative as to whether Noble Six was male or female.
What do you suppose the record is for the longest time anyone survived in the ending of Halo Reach? It does really say, good. For what it's worth, that there was a glitch that was found where you could create a fort out of crates and hide and live forever.
Mm.
And so Noble Six can feasibly survive for eternity.
And as a result, Reach never falls?
I guess.
So?
Yay!
Because the cinematic only triggers once you're dead?
Once you die, yeah.
Reach was also the first Halo game that allowed players to not only customize their multiplayer Spartan, but also their campaign version as well. In multiplayer, they allowed the Elite model to be customizable as well, but this time, playing as an Elite was reserved for specific game types. Because of this, Bungie was able to make some notable design differences between Elites and Spartans that they hadn't been able to do in the past. As stated previously, Spartans and Reach were designed with CE's mechanics in mind, i.e. health pickups instead of regeneration. Elites, however, were larger in scale and faster, which fit the lore better. And their shields and health were rechargeable and at a quicker rate than the Spartan counterparts. Alongside this, Bungie once again implemented their to-be-expected game types and added a few more for good measure, as they were wont to do. Notably, they continued the PvE mode firefight that had been introduced in ODST, and they also revamped and upgraded the Forge system from Halo 3. Since Reach was to be Bungie's last soiree in Halo, they planned to put everything they could into it, and for the most part, they did. Nevertheless, Reach marked the end of Bungie making Halo. Bungie finally had to let their franchise go, relinquishing their side of control completely to Microsoft and the newly found Halo-driven developers 343 Industries.
There, but by the grace of God, go we.
Named for their character Guilty Spark. The new studio would consist of new developers. Right. The new studio would consist of new developers and some old Bungie employees who wanted to stay with the franchise. With the split complete, Bungie could begin to explore new IP and new horizons. Before we move on, I would be remiss not to mention Bungie.net, which I haven't brought up basically at all. Not only has it been an invaluable source of information for these episodes, it's also a very important aspect of Bungie's history. Through their website, Bungie persisted and dedicated themselves to connecting their community as much as possible. It offered stats for players, forums, and ever-present line of communication with Bungie and the developers. It's for reasons like their website that Bungie had maintained such a dedicated fan base for nearly 20 years, but alas, we move on to their next horizon and Destiny.
Aha!
So,
get it.
Destiny always arrives.
So, Destined for Activision. I will also acknowledge Jason Shearer, for his wonderful insight in his book Blood, Sweat, and Pixels. A lot of this information comes from him, as well as all of the additional research that I was doing, which is mostly interviews and articles based on this time frame in Bungie's history.
I'd also like to take this opportunity to acknowledge Jason Shearer, but not because he's done anything for me, just because I felt like I should.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy. You can acknowledge him.
I can acknowledge anybody I want.
Yeah,
I'm an adult.
So, you guys might not remember from episode 2.
That's fair.
But Jason Jones had taken a sabbatical. But at the development of Destiny, he was back. Jason Jones desired to work on a new intellectual property now that Halo was wrapping up. Jamie Griesmer, who had worked with Bungie since Myth and was a design lead on most of the Halo games, actually, interestingly enough, he got hired for Myth, and then he just kept coming to work. Huh. And then he just kept coming to work. And then he just kept coming to work.
So did nobody just have the balls to fire him? Is that
basically? And he ended up as one of the most important design leads for Halo. He a lot of his stank is just put all over drifter. The Halo trilogy. Anyways, so Griesmer revealed to Jones and the other senior Bungie staff a project named Dragon's Tavern. By 2007, Griesmer had grown tired of working on Halo and decided to start on something that was expressly not Halo. Dragon's Tavern would be a third-person fantasy game with a shared world experience. Jones liked the general idea for Dragon Tavern, but with voting power on his side, Bungie decided that instead of making exactly what Griesmer had pitched, they would incorporate some of it into Jones' next project. For Bungie, it was only feasible to make one game after Halo wrapped, and it was definitely going to be Jones, because Jones is the part owner of the Bungie. Guy. Yeah. From 07 to 2010, Destiny, then named Project Tiger, went through several iterations. At one point, it looked like Diablo.
Hey.
At another point, it looked like Overwatch.
Oh.
They weren't sure what the game was going to necessarily be, but they did know it needed to live up to the standard of from the people who brought you Halo. During this time, Griesmer recalls total resets of assets, programming, and design, noting at one point he had gone on vacation for a week, came back, and everything he had worked on for a year was deleted off Bungie's computers. Like, not, recoverable, like, just do a reset.
They nuked it to the ground.
Yeah, they absolutely decimated it, and the only reason that he was able to get any of that back is he had some backed up on his own personal laptop. Over time...
Wait, hold on, sorry. Was that by accident, or was that because somebody made an executive decision?
Someone made an executive decision.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, that's
how bad the tumultuous run of early Destiny was.
Great.
Over time, the ODST and Reach teams jumped onto production of Destiny, and the aesthetic slowly transitioned into sci-fi with a fantasy twist rather than just fantasy, and third person transitioned into first person. Effectively, that was what Bungie was good at, so why would they change it?
Yeah.
As Jamie Griesmer explained, and this is kind of a paraphrase of it, but Bungie could not escape the Halo gravity well.
That's right.
Yeah. On the other hand, Jones was determined to not repeat what he saw as a mistake they had made with Halo, which was, he believed, that the game was way too linear. The player had no agency to the outcome. Once the story was done, the only reason to go back was out of joy rather than depth, which I don't necessarily agree with. I think there is quite a bit of depth. Well, to Halo?
Irrespective of that, right? Like, the idea that... I mean, this is getting off track, but, like, the idea that, like, linear storytelling is some kind of, like, bad word is, exactly. I think, really silly, right? Because, like, a lot of the time, one of the ways that you tell really, really gripping narratives is by specifically pointing the player at the cool thing.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and in the order that makes sense, you know, and then that way, like, for example, we don't run into the problems that you have with, like, Mass Effect or Skyrim or whatever the fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. Those games are great, but they serve different purposes in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. So I support linear narratives. Just throwing it out there.
And I will, spoiler alert, you'd be fired from Bungie. That's but we'll get to that. And with that, Bungie finally settled that Destiny was going to be a shooter meets MMO. And that was a direct quote from Activision, effectively. With the idea finalized, Bungie began shopping for funding and ended up signing a 10-year publishing deal with Activision Studios to make sure their new baby Destiny could truly be the next cultural touchstone.
Boo.
Harold Ryan, the then president of Bungie, stated in 2010 that we chose to partner with... This is great. This is a full quote. We chose to partner with Activision. Ooh. This is how I've imagined Harold Ryan talks. It isn't, but whatever. We chose to partner with Activision on our next IP because of their global reach, multi-platform experience, and marketing expertise. Okay. From working together over the past 9 months on this agreement, it is clear that Activision supports our commitment to giving our fans the best possible gaming experience.
Ooh.
A contract was signed that basically lined out that Activision would retain exclusive publishing rights to the Destiny franchise, but Bungie would retain all rights to the IP.
Yay!
Seemingly, Bungie learned from their deals with Take-Two and Microsoft and were no longer willing to trade their intellectual property for further publishing.
Yay!
The contract laid out that Bungie would develop four MMO-style first-person action shooter games, released every other year from 2013 until the end of the contract. The contract discussed the financial breakdown for the companies, citing that Activision would give Bungie $500 million over 10 years. This would be the largest game contract to ever exist in gaming.
Yay!
Question mark?
Considering Harold Ryan's quote, this seemed like a move Bungie was happy to make. However, like any change, things were shaking up at Bungie. Griesmer, growing further frustrated with how his once far removal from the Halo project had been stripped down, beaten, and misshapen back into Halo. He decided he needed to truly start challenging Bungie as to why and how they were going to make this game. Email blasting the entire company, Griesmer asked these simple questions with less than simple answers. First, number one. A. How are they going to handle this transition to the next-gen consoles without sacrificing cool features just to fit their game on last-gen hardware?
Badly.
Two.
How? And B. How were they going to make content that stayed fresh no matter how many times people replayed it?
They didn't.
Three. Third. C. How would they marry the precise shooting of an action game, in which your proficiency is based on skill, with the treadmill progression of an MMO, in which your character's strength is dependent mostly on levels and gear?
Weird and arbitrary balance patches.
So, shortly after this...
simple answers for complicated questions.
Does anyone have an idea what happened after these questions were email blasted to the entirety of the company?
He was fired.
Griesmer was asked to resign.
Hey!
What the hell?
Although he views his resignation as a badge of honor, as he believed he was true to himself. Either things were going to change for the better, or they would force him out. Over the coming years, though, that certainly wouldn't be the last senior employee to be forced to quit or let go from Bungie.
Womp womp.
But alas, Bungie started feeling confident that they could finally let the world know what they were working on. And despite selling the product as a shooter MMO to Activision, Bungie execs tried to dissuade anyone from calling it an MMO. If you guys remember all of the promotional materials, whenever a reporter or journalist would say, oh, Destiny's this new sci-fi shooter MMO, they're like, not an MMO.
Yeah, I remember calling it an MMO and having people be like, no, it's not.
Instead, it's a shared world shooter. That was another quote voice.
SWS.
Yeah. Jason Jones explained to the press, one lesson that's critical Or I should do a Jason Jones voice. Let's go. I don't know how, I do know how Jason Jones talks, critical. But he just talks like a normal American guy, so I'm going to make another voice for him. One lesson that's critical is that... No, that's a terrible voice. I'm going to cut it back. One lesson that's critical is that the most important stories we tell aren't going to be told by us. They're going to be told by players. They're personal legends built from shared adventures.
That sounds lazy.
Well, that ties into their marketing material, if you guys remember. Do you remember the tagline for Destiny? The marketing tagline.
It's your destiny.
No.
Oh.
Seize your destiny.
No, it has nothing to do with the word destiny.
It was, hey guys, we didn't write a story for this, so figure it out.
Become legendary.
Oh!
Wait.
Oh!
Become destiny.
No. Come on, you're so close, James. You can do it.
Destiny.
Break the egg.
It's not Halo.
Break the egg, buddy. Break the egg.
Are a legend.
No, oh, you were closer with the other one.
Become
immense.
The legend.
Ah, you're never gonna get it. Become legend.
I was close.
You said become legendary. Yeah. With that in mind,
the cow you are.
Mm-hmm. With that in mind, Bungie started touting further press material that Destiny was a quote shared experience from game design to internal structure. Shared was Bungie's goal. Behind the scenes, however, the story and vision of Destiny was anything but shared. Joseph Staten, the longtime narrative lead for Bungie, and his writing team had been working away at filling the world of Destiny with interesting characters, lore, and plotlines. At one point, Pete Parsons, the COO of Bungie at the time, and now the president of Bungie, I believe, made the claim, "We like to..." Another quote here. "We like to party." We like to party. We like to tell big stories.
Keep going.
Okay. Bring down the level just a little bit. There we go. "We like to tell big stories, and we want people to put the Destiny universe on the same shelf they put Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Star Wars."
Woof.
Yeah. That was one of the
record
early
scratch. Questions. Yeah, really.
However, internally, the only people who knew the story for Destiny were the
Nobody.
Writers and Jones.
Oh.
Which certainly meant that there wasn't a shared vision for the rest of the company. And although Staten had been told that he should keep moving forward in the direction he was going by Jones himself, Jones was adamant that Destiny shouldn't and wouldn't be as linear as Halo, which is what Staten had been effectively writing. In the past, with smaller numbers, Bungie was capable of great communication between its departments, but with the influx of money from Activision, the influx of employees, and a lack of unified vision or leadership, work for the game was growing more and more disparate. Each piece of the puzzle was effectively being built without any knowledge of how it would connect to the first bits of work or how it might connect to future work. Noticing this turmoil, Staten stepped up in an attempt to unify the workforce, released his, what they will now call,
manifesto.
Supercut.
Oh.
Yeah, no, not a, this isn't a school shooting situation, I don't think, anyways. He released his supercut.
It's a shared shooting.
Of the Destiny universe and, Destiny universe and story. With its release, O'Donnell noted, Martin O'Donnell, the longtime composer for Bungie.
Wolf O'Donnell.
Noted, Joe's vision probably made tons of sense in his own mind.
That's
he also speculated, Staten probably thought, here it is, this isn't perfect, but we can fix it. To me, this was much like Griesmer's questions. Staten was trying to force things to change for the better. Nevertheless, much like Griesmer's questions, Staten's supercut was not well received. Jones immediately went to work on completely rebooting the story. It was a big call. Bungie at this point had delayed the game from 2013 to 2014. In less than a year, they needed to not only reboot the story, but also make it work within the confines of the game that they had created up to this point. Activision was not happy with this decision, but with the delay already implemented, Jones convinced them Bungie could make it happen. Jones then created two new divisions for this endeavor. One was Iron Bar, I-R-O-N, bar, like an ingot of sorts.
Right. Mm.
Made up of Jason Jones, Luke Smith, who was a designer, Chris Barrett, who was an art designer, and Eric Rabe, an editor Bungie had hired to write Destiny lore. It is interesting to note that in Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, Jason Shear takes a dig at specifically Chris and Luke for basically rising through Bungie through mediocrity.
Right. They failed upwards.
Yeah, effectively. And so how they got here, Jason Shear kind of just shrugs his shoulders for this. So
Jason
I found that kind of...
shrugs his shoulders.
Yeah, I was... I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. Iron Bar was mandated to create the new story outline and fill it. The other division was Blacksmith, which
Sorry, was to clarify with Iron Bar, if they're the ones in charge of rejiggering the story, was there a writer on that staff that you were mentioning?
No, there wasn't.
Great.
No, there wasn't. Yeah. That's the interesting part.
Just checking.
Yeah. And noticeably, Joseph Staten, the longtime narrative lead,
yes,
wasn't.
And he was not a writer.
Yeah. Well, no, he was not on Iron Bar.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yes. And his writing staff that he had at the time also were not a part of Iron Bar.
Great.
So the other division was Blacksmith, which was made up of team leads that would give feedback on the outlines Iron Bar would provide. Staten was openly against this action and pleaded that the supercut could still be saved. But alas, with the new divisions taking over his story and him releasing the supercut, Staten effectively wrote his death march, and by the end of summer 2013,
he was
left
fired.
The company. He left the company accordingly. Like, sure. That was at least the...
It was allegedly.
Yeah. But, I mean...
He was rumored to have been fired. You heard it here first.
For Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, Jason Schur noted that Joseph Staten refused an interview, but Jamie Griesmere did not. And so a lot of the Jamie Griesmere parts were direct quotes from him saying that he was asked to resign, which kind of feels like something that Bungie was doing maybe to avoid sink falls of money.
Well, and if he refused, right? Like, when you are asked to resign, it's a very fancy way of saying that you've been fired.
Yeah. No, but the difference is that if you're fired, you get a severance. If you are asked to leave, you get dick all. Mm. Nevertheless, the quote from Joseph Staten after he left the company is, "After 15 great years at Bungie, from the battlefields of myth to the mysteries of Halo and beyond, I'm leaving to tackle new creative challenges. While this may come as a surprise, fear not. It's been my pleasure building Destiny these past 4 years, and after the big reveal this summer, our hugely talented team is on track for greatness. I'll be cheering all of them, with all of you, when the game launches next year. Thank you for the support of me and your continued support of Bungie. We couldn't have done it without you." This, as a reminder, would not be the end of Bungie losing its senior officers. Destiny was first shown to the public by Staten and Jones at E3 just at the beginning of that summer, 2013. Mm-hmm. Much like they had done when revealing Halo 2, they showed off their new project by actually playing the game. This was accompanied by a trailer which showed off the very base structure of Destiny's story. Remember, this is before the rebooting of the story. Now, originally, the trailer was scored by Martin O'Donnell and Michael Salvatore, which, I mean, of course it was. They were the Halo guys. But they also got Paul motherfucking McCartney to help with the composition.
Dope.
But that's not what was in the trailer.
Oh.
Instead, Activision had rescored the trailer with its own music.
Oh.
O'Donnell was pissed. He tweeted about it, which caused Activision's then-president, Eric Hirschberg, to email Harold Ryan to make O'Donnell take down his tweets, which he did not. Over the coming months and the countdown year to the release of Destiny,
O'Donnell was fired.
O'Donnell found himself continuously at odds with his coworkers. He was placed on Blacksmith Division and was constantly pointing out flaws Iron Bar had been incorporating as they tore down Staten's original ideas. As the audio director, he was then also forced to work with the big-name actors they had produced or procured for the game, like Peter Dinklage, Nathan Fillion, Bill Nighy, Lance
all
Reddick.
All right, Dinklage.
Bill Nighy? The science guy?
Bill
Nighy.
Nighy. For people Bill who Nighy. Need examples of Bill Nighy, he was Davy Jones in Pirates of the Caribbean. He was also the lead vampire in the first Underworld movie.
Yeah.
He's been in a whole bunch of stuff, but those are two sci-fi things that he's been in.
Yeah. And I'd forgotten about Dinklebot because he got replaced by Nolan North.
Correct.
Later on.
Yeah. And Gina Torres.
Yeah. They got all of Firefly after all.
Not quite, because again, Jules Staten and then those people.
They're working on it. It's a process.
Yes, but he had been forced to work with them with what he considered to be a subpar story and worse dialogue. And in April 2014, O'Donnell once again tweeted his conflicts with his company and told the world, "I am saddened to say that Bungie's board of directors terminated me without cause." He would eventually file suit and win a case against his former employers.
Ah!
Yeah. So throughout the development of Destiny, Bungie also parted ways with other senior staff, Vic DeLoyan, which was one of their senior environmental artists, Adrian Perez, who was one of their senior engineers, Marcus Leto, who was the creative director of Halo Reach and the longtime art director for Halo, and Paul Bertone, the design director, and eventually Harold Ryan in 2016 during the additional content being added to Destiny and the development of Destiny 2.
Man, this is just a new ship now.
Yep. Among the constant restructuring of the game code, design, and even departments as they were losing leads left, right, and center, Bungie was working with an engine they had designed for Halo Reach. Unfortunately, with the power of the next-gen consoles and the depth and breadth of what they wanted to do in this shared-world shooter, the engine was often chugging to keep up. Small changes being implemented, and this is a paraphrase from one of the employees that Jason Shearer interviewed, took minutes to change, while bigger changes took tens of minutes to change. It slowed progress for the entire development cycle. But let's finally get into what Destiny became. because we talked about it being Diablo, talked about it being Overwatch, talked about a shared world shooter, whatever the fuck that means.
SWS!
But Destiny is a sci-fi MMO looter shooter. That's what it is. Players could choose one of three classes for their guardians to be hunters, who are effectively a rogue type, titans, who are effectively a paladin or warrior type, or warlocks, who are effectively your magic users. Each class was also then given a choice of two subclasses, depending on the type of energy they drew their power from. Each class and subsequent class had varying base stats, growth parameters, and supers that could create a more unique playstyle for each player. However, despite the marketed differences, each class equaled to effectively the same power level depending on the player's progression, for balancing not only in PvE, but PvP especially. Destiny's PvE included the game's story and player progression. Players would start by gaining experience and levels typical to any RPG. After the player reached level 20, however, the game's character progression became tied to their, quote, light level, which was determined by the quality of their weapons and armor. Like most shooters with loot-based mechanics, weapons and armors were divided by rarity and quality, common, uncommon, rare, mythic, and legendary. Obtaining loot was determined by RNG, or random number generators, and was implemented by engrams for the players. They were effectively different colored dodecahedrons that the player would open and receive, through RNG, a piece of loot. The colors corresponded to the rarity of loot, but even that was merely a guideline and a slider to the potential rewards inside. Players could find better and more reliable loot with higher difficulty missions within the game. There were daily and weekly operations that had players replay story missions at varying difficulties, and strikes and raids and in-game events. Teams in Destiny were made up of three players. In strikes, three players would go through a side mission that wasn't a part of the main story and eventually fight some sort of boss, gaining rewards from that. Raids were six-player missions that were longer and larger incorporated fights and puzzles completely unique to any of the previous missions played. Raids were often the most difficult challenge in the game, and as a result, for the best loot for the player to obtain.
Like PvP. World of Warcraft.
Yeah, basically. Or any MMO ever. In fact, they use the same nomenclature, so again,
but it's not an MMO. It's important.
It's an SWS. PvP, or Crucible, as it was named in the game, was Bungie's typical array of multiplayer. It featured control points, team deathmatch, free-for-all, and more as expansions and DLC came out for the game. Loot could also be obtained through PvP, but it was dependent on RNG and had nothing to do with skill. In fact, players tried to not necessarily data mine, but trial and error, that a lot of the time, if you were at the lowest position at PvP, that's when you would typically get rewards. This was never fully proven, but it was something that players notably...
There was information to suggest.
Yeah, exactly. Destiny was released September 9th, 2014. So with the publishers like Activision, developers are given a potential bonus incentive that correlates to the game's Metacritic review score. In particular, Bungie was offered a huge bonus if the game reached an 85. What did the game reach?
Wasn't it 84?
84 is Scott's number.
83!
83? You both are way too generous. It was a 76!
Hey! No.
Fans praised the shooting aspects of the game, both the feeling and the quantity to choose from, but they were disappointed by the game's overall narrative and execution. The story was too shallow in most points and utterly confusing in others. It's like if you write something without writers, it will be bad. Bungie tried to mitigate this by implementing a database exclusively accessed through their website called Grimoire Cards. Fans were generally pleased with the information garnered from the cards, but again were disappointed that the information wasn't just in the game's narrative or even in the game itself.
That's dumb.
Yeah. So, let's try to summarize this story and plot up. This actually, so for Destiny 1, because I was actually really huge into this game, this entire plot summary is based solely on memory, and then I double-checked it to make sure that I didn't fuck it up.
Right.
And I absolutely fucking nailed it. Long ago, a giant white sphere was found on Mars. It was named the Traveler. The Traveler helped humanity colonize and terraform our solar system, giving us access to more resources and land. However, though humanity grew exponentially, the Traveler's presence brought about the attention of its rival, an enigmatic evil force known as...
The stay-at-home guy.
Darkness.
I was thinking that.
They believed in a thing called love.
Ah.
And several alien races known as the Taken, the Vex, the Cabal, the Fallen, and the Hive. The alien races, with support from the darkness, started to divide and conquer humanity until we fell back to the last city.
Mars.
No. That's the name of the city. It's called the last city.
Well, that's a little fatalistic, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Couldn't we have called it, like, Happiness Town or something?
It was put in old Russia, so...
Goodsville.
No.
No, God, where do you want to go? Oh, how about the last city? Yeah, that seems good. Okay. What about the second last city? Yeah, I'd rather take my chances.
Backs against the wall, gentlemen. The three playable races, humans, Exo, and Awoken, have struggled to survive in this post-apocalyptic system. There is hope.
I have a question. Was the last city always called the last city, or did it become the last city once it was the last city?
Scott, yes. You would have to know a writer to get information like that.
Yeah.
Which clearly Bungie didn't have because they fired him.
I'm just saying, could it have been called like
Jimtown?
Chadstown.
Yeah. Like, and then when they ran out of other cities, they're like, oh, it's the last city. We should call it that.
You think that it was the last city they named, and so they named it the last city?
No, I'm saying so previously, like, it's in Russia, right? So let's say it's like Johannesburg or whatever the fuck.
Yes, Johannesburg. Noticeably Russia. In Russia.
Yeah, Johannesburg, yeah. Russia.
Yeah, Johannesburg, yeah. Russia.
Okay, Moscow.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Johannesburg, yeah. Russia, as you do.
Yes.
I'm saying, if it was called Johannesburg and then all the other cities got destroyed and then it became the last city, or was it called the last city, but then you could go off to Medicine Hat to pick up some stuff and then come back to the last city, you know?
I can only answer this with an emphatic shoulder shrug.
Right. No one knows.
I'm sure it's somewhere in the Grimoire cards. Would you like to peruse?
Yes.
Yeah, all right. Among advancing humanity, the Traveler also gifted the playable races powers from the cosmos,
whoa,
which birthed the Guardians, a legion of protectors who were imbued with light.
Great.
That's it.
Oh, that's it, where your light
it,
level comes
it,
from.
Yeah, it's a thing that they can have. They hold on to it. Okay. The player's guardian, as the story goes, was long dead in an ancient battle, but his/her ghost, a sapient drone created to support, revive, and locate those who can hold the light, or just guardians, has found the player just outside of old Russia. The rest of the story, well, this is a direct quote from the game, I don't have time to explain why I don't have time to explain.
Fuck you.
Yeah, that was a direct quote from the game. That's right. That was the kind of genius dialogue that Martin O'Donnell had to work with for the speaker, who was voiced by Bill Nighy.
Fuck you.
But actually, I do have time to explain it. It wasn't great. And effectively, the goal is to give the playable races a foothold in taking back the solar system. Nailed it.
Oh, okay. Hold on. So prior to the last city being the last city,
okay,
it was called the city. It was just the city.
That makes sense.
And then became the last city once the other cities stopped being cities.
Okay. Yep.
Yep.
As I said, it wasn't met well. But yet, players kept coming back into the fray of Destiny. There was definitely something there, and Bungie knew it. They just needed to figure out what it was and how to implement it. In the lifespan of Destiny, Bungie released several expansions, The Dark Below, House of Wolves, The Taken King, and Rise of Iron. The first two were small but important, as Bungie was dedicated to scouring their fan base as to how to fix their game. Much like the very sour release for Diablo 3 from Blizzard, also published by Activision, they figured they could work their way out of the hole if only they could incorporate the right ideas from their community. And
I'm sorry, I'm just really mad I'm reading this. So, they've definitely, on the naming conventions, they've taken the Tolkien approach, where they've just, like, the big forest, but it's capitalized, basically.
Yep.
So, for the city, so in the Dark Age, which followed, which came after the Collapse, there was the Dark Age, and Guardians and survivors of the Collapse began searching for a new place to call home. During this time, legends began circulating among the survivors of a refuge beneath the Traveler, which begun the City Age, where they found the city, which then became the last city.
Good to know.
Yeah.
In the second year of the game, they released the Taken King expansion, released September 8th, 2015, just a year after release. Though the previous two installments had slowly patched and refined the core gameplay, the Taken King went above and beyond and created an experience players truly enjoyed. And in spite of all the flack the game got, it not only sold well, somewhere close to 500 million US on its first week, but in 1 year, according to Bungie and Activision, the game had nearly 25 million registered users.
Great.
It was shaky as far as reviews went and fan outcry, and it never really answered the very important questions asked by Griezmer, but nevertheless, in the end, Bungie and Activision considered the game a success.
Hooray.
Good for them.
All right. The modern era, guys.
Uh-oh.
We're right near the end.
We're at D2.
It's been a hell of a journey.
But we made it.
We're getting there. It's the last little bit. Here we go. The last game Bungie released was Destiny 2.
Yay.
As according to the contract Activision implemented. Now, in the original contract, Activision had planned that Destiny would have 4 games in 10 years, releasing every second year. In the interim year, Bungie would release an expansion that was originally codenamed Comet. Effectively, in Destiny 1, Comet was the Taken King expansion. At the time, things were generally on track for Activision's contract, except Destiny 2 released September 6, 2017.
So that's late.
That's 3 years after the release of the first game. So already, scheduling, not great. Bungie announced early 2016 that the game would be delayed, giving fans ample time to adjust, but it was clear that Activision and Bungie were now publicly bumping heads. To get this story out of the way, and I did play half of Destiny 2's main storyline, so again, I just did it from memory and then was totally bang on, so right. Good for me on that.
Sure.
Destiny 2 starts with the Cabal leader destroying the last city.
Damn it.
And sucking up the light from the Traveler. This knocks out all Guardian's powers, and the last bastion of humanity is forced to disperse across the solar system.
Damn.
The player finds a piece of the Traveler in an unexpected place and regains his or her power.
Oh.
It is learned that there is a way to reinfuse the light and to awaken the Traveler.
Hooray.
But the players must first destroy a planet-destroying ship commanded by the Cabal.
Oh, damn.
After the player finally awakens the Traveler,
yay!
It is revealed that there is a mystery about the Traveler that the leaders of the last city have never completely told the truth about.
Boo?
Dun, dun, dun.
Boo?
Without dun. The Traveler, there cannot be the anti-Traveler.
Please, you don't have time to explain why you can't explain.
Okay.
I don't have nearly the time nor the crayons to explain what's going on to you.
All right. So sales were considered pretty solid for Destiny 2 at launch, but just outside of a year from release, Activision made a public announcement that the game was underselling. On its release, Destiny 2 was certainly better received than its predecessor, but fans and critics once again started berating Bungie because they believed that the end state of Destiny 1 was actually far superior to the beginning state of Destiny 2. Taking the criticism to heart once again, Bungie began fine-tuning and fidgeting with their newest game. The game was launched with new subclasses. For their Trinity. Fans enjoyed the new subclasses.
Oh, that's good.
Bungie also got rid of the Grimoire cards, which were highly criticized, and added the lore of Destiny Universe back into the narrative and within items and scannable objects in the game, much like a Dark Souls game, for example.
Yay.
Was also very appreciated by fans.
That's However, fine.
The core gameplay loops and loot drops were a significant step backwards from where Destiny 1 had landed. On top of that, shortly after release, it was revealed that Bungie had also been... Do you guys remember this controversy?
Stealing our data.
Throttling experience.
Oh, yeah, I do remember this.
So, basically, if players played for too long, they would eventually get less and less experience, despite harder challenges they may face, or whatever they were doing. It didn't matter.
Dick move.
Time effectively meant that your experience gain was going to drop, and your loot drops were also... The percentage was also going to drop.
So don't play!
This caused quite an uproar across the gaming industry. Bungie formally apologized, and once again found themselves at the bottom of a pit. Needing desperately to work their way out. Destiny 2 has, at this point, several expansions. This includes Curse of Osiris, Warmind, Forsaken, and most recently, Shadowkeep. With each installment, much like Destiny 1, Bungie started finding their footing more and more. However, as stated, Activision and Bungie were bumping heads, and in 2019, Bungie and Activision... Split. Announced they were parting ways.
Hooray!
Triumphantly, Bungie not only finally got to hold on to their IP, unlike their time with Take-Two and Microsoft, but they also bought back their publishing rights to the franchise. Now, I only started bringing this up in this last section, but in the wake of Bungie and Activision officially splitting, it has been heavily rumored, even within the companies, but with no exact confirmation that Bungie and Activision had been rubbing each other the wrong way since day one. As it goes, Activision is the money.
Yay.
Their bottom line, and in most cases, are to their investors.
Oh.
Though most microtransactions in Destiny were considered unobtrusive to the gameplay, they were still pushed heavily as a way to ensure that Destiny was never not making money. With their contract, Activision had also a proverbial and provisional axe hanging over Bungie, mandated that there needed to be regular content updates and annual expansions. The comment, as it was originally named, was that annual expansion.
Sure.
This put a lot of pressure onto Bungie, as it was later revealed. Bungie, in the wake of the separation, was reported to be ecstatic over the split. In their main offices, Bungie cheered and pop champagne as they once again retain their independence. Though they thanked Activision for the 8-year partnership, Bungie announced that they would be taking the helm once again and delivering content that players could and would be happy to play. In the time of Destiny 2, the game has also gone free to play across all its platforms. Yay. Effectively, the first year of content is available for all new players, and if they would like to carry on their experiences, they can then buy the most recent expansions. Since the breakup, players have reported that Destiny 2 has become that much more of an enjoyable experience.
Great.
So, all good. And that's basically it, guys. We've got to the end. That's the end of Bungie's history.
Damn.
Expansion passes.
So Shadowkeep is their first expansion.
Yeah.
Without Activision.
Post-Activision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I said, across the board, players have been reporting that Bungie is back. Now, saying that, if you recall, I talked about two guys, Luke Smith and Chris Barrett, who were the leads on Iron Bar.
They're the ones that failed upwards.
Yes. They are senior execs for Bungie currently.
Womp womp.
So as much as things are going better for Bungie, and this is the speculation portion of the podcast, really, it's not like they're going... Bungie is never going to return to Halo. The glory days of Halo.
No.
Much like in most game development, things are very dependent on all of those small pieces coming together in a very spectacular way. It's amazing that games even get developed with how much work and input from each individual that's required to make a game really exist. And the fact that Bungie consistently like raised the bar at every step of their development was not a miracle. Those were people working hard, but it was a testament to who Bungie was. Bungie today isn't who Bungie was, but we can hope that Bungie will maintain some sort of rise.
Well, so, I mean, what's the good news with where we're at right now, ending this podcast on a semi-positive note, is that, like, I think one of the takeaways with Bungie is that as they got increasingly corporate, it became harder and harder to maintain their clear vision, right?
That's like, exactly it.
They absolutely made... They made the games that they wanted to make for the first sort of 10 years of their existence, including the first Halo game.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then Halo became so wildly successful and they became so roped in this sort of like global geopolitical game development thing that so then they made Halo for the rest of forever.
Yep.
And then that was fine until people started to burn out and drop off, but it didn't matter because people were still buying Halo games, so they had to keep making Halo games.
Yep.
And then they dropped off, started making Destiny, which became a large enough and popular enough project that it got picked up by a different geopolitical video game entity that caused them to make the thing that they didn't want to make. And now that they're free and clear, either they'll make the same mistake for the third time in a row, or they'll potentially go back to how they were in like the late 90s.
So notably, NetEase, one of the aspects of buying their way out of the publishing contract with Activision is that NetEase gave Bungie $100 million.
Woo, Jenna!
To just create a new game. So luckily, that $100 million has nothing, accordingly to Bungie, nothing to do with the furtherment of Destiny.
Sure.
Which is pretty cool.
Yes.
And as far as NetEase money-making moves go, that's one of the better terms I've heard.
Well, and of course, you know, Chinese money notoriously comes string-free.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
as we well know of in this current day and age.
Yeah.
But it's exactly what you were saying. Ah, sorry. It was exactly what you were saying, Scott. I think that Bungie, deep in their soul, the core mandates of Bungie, they believe themselves to be a indie company in the sense that maybe not by the numbers, maybe not by the sales, but by their attitude. They're a little punk rock, or that's what they see themselves as.
Sure.
They're rebels of sorts. And so every time they've had overlords like Take-Two or Microsoft or Activision, and even Microsoft, as far as parting ways, they thought they treated Bungie very well. But nevertheless, Bungie cheered for their Declaration of Independence back in 2007. But nevertheless, Bungie has always had this fuck you attitude towards their money, which they made those games from. So hopefully this independence
continues.
Hopefully it means that they can actually fulfill their punk rock destiny of sorts. No pun intended to their actual Destiny game.
Third game, punk rock Destiny.
That'd actually be pretty fucking sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we'll see. I think most people are pretty excited to see how Bungie will kind of land. It's still up in the air. Obviously, the things they've implemented in Destiny 2 since the split up has been well received, but with game development, so much of it is backloaded. You don't really know what's actually getting factored into the mix once things are released.
Well, and realistically, like, yes, this, what's it called? Shadowkeep is the first thing that they have made post-Activision, but that doesn't mean that it was the first thing in development post-Activision.
Exactly.
And, like, the largest the real test of where Bungie's going is going to be either probably the next big Destiny thing if they continue on with Destiny,
yeah,
or whatever it is that is going to be the next big IP on the horizon.
Yeah, something like, in 2022, maybe on the next gen consoles.
The real test is going to be the next thing that they're doing that is irrespective of stuff that existed in the previous era.
Exactly. Also notably, there were two expansions that Activision had their smaller divisions working on that nobody knows what happened to them after the split. We knew that they were getting worked on, but as far as post-split, it seems like why would Activision be still pumping money into something that they no longer gain money from?
They won't. Yeah,
exactly.
And it's not like they'll have sold the half-finished product to Bungie or anything like that. They'll have just scrapped it.
Yeah,
it'll be burned to the ground.
Yeah, and if they did sell it back to Bungie, I'm sure that Bungie would be bankrupt buying it from Activision.
Yeah, and they probably don't want it anyway.
Yeah, at this point. But the last thing that I wanted to end on, if that's okay, is kind of a where are they now? As far as the bigger players that we've talked about for Bungie.
All right, we'll do it Animal House style.
Yeah, sort of. Alex Hropian, who was the original co-founder, one of the co-founders, founded the studio Industrial Toys, which develops mobile games for core gamers and was recently purchased by EA. Jason Jones is still heavily involved with development and progression of Bungie and obviously Destiny. Joseph Staten returned to work with Microsoft Studios and most recently was the lead writer for the game, and this kind of unfortunate, ReCore.
Oh.
It was well received.
I very vaguely recall ReCore.
It was well received, but it was a mediocre game at best. Like a real solid 7.5.
Mm.
From what I understand. I haven't played it at all, so that's all speculation. Martin O'Donnell founded a new studio named Highwire Games and has released a VR title named Golem. Unfortunately. Harold Ryan founded a new studio called Probably Monsters that has very recently, October 29th, 2019, announced that they would be participating in the gaming industry by creating and facilitating new teams to develop new games. So they're not...
So they're a publisher, kind of?
Sort of. They're more of a headhunter.
They're like a temp agency.
A little bit, but they create stable game companies from that.
Okay.
So, yes, they are kind of a publisher, but they're also kind of developers.
Isn't that what Square Enix did and then, like, wasted a whole bunch of money and didn't go anywhere?
Yes, but that was... That's a whole other episode to talk about all the shit that Square Enix has done wrong.
Sure.
Yeah. Marcus Leto founded a game studio called V1 Interactive and is close to releasing their sci-fi shooter, Disintegration, which we've talked about on Hit Continue podcast and has been highlighted by Jeff Keighley in most recent kind of world gaming events and so on and so forth. And then finally, Jamie Griesmer found himself in camp with Martin O'Donnell and currently works with Highwire Games. So, and many Bungie employees that got fired during the time of Destiny or let go also landed at 343 Industries. There's a slew of them.
Back on Halo.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So one of the things that we saw with Halo 4 and Halo 5. Out. Yeah, they pull you back in.
Yep.
Yeah. Though Halo 5 was really shat on across the board.
Yeah. It was certainly a thing.
There were a lot of marketable improvements from Halo 4 from what 343 was trying to do with it.
Okay.
But nevertheless, that's the end. That's the end of the Bungie series.
We jumped out the bridge. Our wire extended completely, and now we have recoiled back onto the bridge.
Mm, like some sort of rope. Scott, you got it. It's right there. It's on the tip of your tongue.
Twine.
That really reminds us all of lynching. That's not good.
Elasticy.
Yeah. It's something.
It's like a spring,
But not a spring.
Yeah.
A slinky.
Kind of.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Slinky.
Yeah.
Sorry. Bungie. Got it. Nailed it. Yeah. And then next on our docket, we will do a very small episode, something like 20 or 30 minutes that we'll kind of do on the fly because me personally, as I have done a lot of research for this and written a lot of information for this series, I'm going to take just a wee break on my research
game. The next one's going to be slapdash as fuck.
No. It's going to be on... the positions that make up a game, and we're just going to describe them because I figured that not a lot of people know what a designer actually does, or what the difference between developer and producer, or publisher, or
what's the difference between a director and a creative lead.
Exactly, so on and so forth. Sure. So we're going to go over that, and then we will be moving on to the next game creator, and it'll be super fun. So hopefully you'll join us on...
We do.
But I wanted to save it.
Oh.
Because it's... super secret special. But I hope you join us on that venture into our next metagame. Thank you, everybody. Thank you guys for sitting on this and going on this journey with me.
Couldn't have done it without me.
And go met a game of your own.
Woof.
Bye.